EJ and Tony. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Dawn, always a pleasure. Great to be with you today.
And EJ, you know, you don't need the intro because we all know you. EJ Antoni, research fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Grover Hermann Center for the Federal Budget and Research, focusing, of course, on fiscal and monetary policy. But I don't know. I just think I like biggity big. Biggity big EJ Antoni, economic genius and guru. I think that's the better title.
I like it. It's very Trumpian. I can picture the former president himself saying it as he moves his hands in the way he always does. I love it. I love it. It's the best, believe me.
So take me through, if we begin even looking at last Friday, what happened Monday morning, this week moving through, and then matching up and thinking about Americans and the reality check of Bidenomics. And I want to insert into there, because there's somebody will call and say, well, you can't blame Biden for the Federal Reserve. You can't blame, he doesn't completely control the Federal Reserve. And the fact that they were slow to push the button and do, deal with the rates. So can you give us your EJ Antoni analysis, but incorporating, those individuals who are going to call, who are Biden supporters and who are going to say, hey, it's not all Biden's fault.
Well, look, it's certainly true that Biden is not the Fed. I mean, that seems pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. But you have to ask, why did the Fed do what they did? Why did they keep interest rates so low for so long? It was because they had to help finance the ridiculous, profligate, runaway spending by the Treasury Department. In other words, Biden pushed through so much spending legislation, trillions upon trillions of dollars worth, that the Treasury had massive deficits that they couldn't actually finance. There literally wasn't enough money available to borrow. And so the Fed had to step in and create the money for the Treasury to borrow. They had to create the money in order for the government to spend it. And also to keep the financing costs on the debt down, they had to plunge interest rates. Well, all of that is coming back to bite us. It already has in the form of higher inflation, 40-year high inflation. But now, in order to try to tame that inflation that the Fed helped cause, they've had to increase interest rates. And again, it's coming back to bite us in a lot of different ways, not only at the federal level, right? Look at federal finance. Mm-hmm. We're spending over $1.1 trillion a year now just to finance the debt. In other words, just interest, not paying a dime towards principal. But aside from federal finance, it's damaged family finance, because now people are having difficulty affording a home. They have high home prices and high interest rates. That's a deadly combination for your monthly mortgage payment. Credit cards are near an all-time high for those interest rates. I don't care whether it's auto loans, student loans, anything in between. These punishingly high interest rates have greatly increased the cost of living crisis for a lot of Americans.
And what's scary to me when we think about any manipulation of financial conditions of the economy and sort of usurping those core functions of the Federal Reserve, that's always scary to me, any kind of manipulation, because I think of 2008 and the crash and all of that. And so, in the way that you beautifully described this, EJ Antoni, in other words, thinking about the Treasury Department, basically what you're saying is, so they're figure, it's kind of, I was trying to think of the analysis, like trying to fund, like if I want to do some spending and I don't want my husband to really see it, so I go to a card with maybe a higher interest rate, but he's not going to see it, so I can still do my spending. And I'm trying to think of a good analogy here that people can relate to, of the Biden Treasury Department and the Biden administration trying to get what they want, basically juice the economy, but then they're sort of manipulating and changing how they're supposed to finance the government. So it's not technically illegal, but it's a manipulation.
Well, one of the things that they're doing, Dawn, at the Treasury Department is they've changed the kind of debt that they're using to finance the annual deficit.
Okay.
So usually we have this very typical mix of treasury bills, treasury bonds, treasury notes. In other words, the amount of time before that debt needs to be repaid is varied. It can be as short as just a few months and as long as 30 years. And there's a lot of reasons why that maturation schedule is the way it is. But what this Treasury Department has been doing is trying to reduce the amount of long-term debt and pile everything into treasury bills or short-term debt. For a couple of different reasons. One is it actually has a temporarily positive effect on liquidity. In other words, it helps private business think there's more cash available than there actually is. It also is going to temporarily help keep down mortgage rates so that people don't feel as much of the burden of government spending. But it is also greatly increasing the cost to service the debt. We're basically paying an extra $100 billion a year in interest on the federal debt right now because of all these manipulations by Janet Yellen trying to control the yield curve here. So at the end of the day, that's just the immediate effect. You have long-term effects that are much worse than that. Look, and this goes for any time, whether it's the Fed or the Treasury or any other part of the federal government tries to manipulate finance. It always snaps back at you, and it is always going to have very catastrophic effects in the long run.
And so part of it is, so take me, can you just, you know, take us through that? Because you're talking about the short-term debt, right, the Treasury bills. And you're saying that that was about the 20% of the outstanding debt. Now, basically, they're saying, oh, that's not 20%. Well, that's like the average, instead of saying, no, that should be your max. Am I right there? So usually they would say, oh, we're not going to go above this amount for that. But now they're saying, oh, no, that's no longer your limit. That's just like the average. That's how they're fudging this.
You know, Dawn, it's very much like they're doing with the overall budget or the size of the debt. And people say, hey, this is reaching alarming levels or this is reaching alarming ratios. And to justify it, they're pointing to extreme moments in history. In other words, when we were in the depths of very bad recessions or when we were at war. And they're saying, oh, well, you know, it did happen before. So this isn't completely new, right? This isn't entirely out of the norm. Well, no, it is out of the norm. You know, you're using an extreme situation to justify what you're doing today. Then that means we must be in another extreme situation. So look, you guys can't have it both ways. You can't say everything is fine and then say, in order to keep everything fine, we have to take all of these extraordinary measures. That points to some very troubling underlying fundamentals.
And so at the end of the day, what is the biggest mistake that you see as you look forward and you see this all unfolding?
I think the biggest mistake in terms of how we got here, at least, has just been the ridiculous levels of spending. I mean, it is absolutely appalling. Now, it is hiding a lot of our economic woes, right? Because when the government spends money, that actually adds to GDP because of the way we calculate that figure. So it makes it look like the economy is growing, even though it really isn't. Likewise, if the government takes a dollar from you and gives it to someone else, you know, that goes under government transfers, but it ultimately gets counted as consumer spending, even though, again, it really is the government moving the money around. So as the government does more and more of both that direct and indirect spending, if you will, it continuously adds to the way we measure the economy, even though the actual private economy, the productive economy, hasn't increased at all. So unfortunately, as much as it is the biggest source of our problems today, it is also the biggest source of positive news, even though that positive news is not reflective of reality. It's not reflective of the lived experience, I think, that your listeners go through day after day.
And so it's a business killer, as far as especially small business. You've said before that the Bidenomics team has ignored the middle class misery, as you've talked about. Take me through, for the average American, what Bidenomics is doing to the average American worker and family.
For the average American worker, it's an incredibly high cost of living, essentially, Dawn. I mean, It's you're paying 40% more for car insurance. You're paying 116% more for your monthly mortgage payment today on a median price home than you did when Biden or Harris took office. That's not an exaggeration. It has more than doubled. I mean, this genuinely is a cost of living crisis. I don't like throwing that term around loosely, but I think it fits in this instance. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of the inflation metrics that we use, things like the Consumer Price Index or CPI, we'll get another reading on that next week, for example, that always grossly understates inflation. And the reason for that is because it doesn't count a lot of price increases, including things from regulation. For example, if the government imposes a new regulation on automobiles that increases the cost per vehicle by, let's say, $5,000, that will show up nowhere in the CPI. Why? Because it purposely excludes any cost increases associated with regulation. It adjusts that out of the equation. And so that's why for literally about two decades, according to the CPI, the price of new vehicles flatlined. It didn't budge. It's only been the last few years that it's gone up at all. Why is that? Because all of those regulatory costs that were imposed on the auto industry were literally just adjusted away by the magical statisticians.
And, you know, as far as this goes, when we think about our economy, are you saying the R word? Recession?
I am. Yeah, no, absolutely, Dawn. I would not be surprised if the recession is eventually backdated to July or August, the current month. And the reason I say backdated is because, you know, we always like to wait until we have several months of very conclusive data before we say, okay, recession began. And the reason for that is because there are plenty of times in history where you have a particularly bad month. And you don't want to all of a sudden say, oh, we began a recession, when it was something that was so short and so temporary that it really doesn't fit that bill. You know, there were plenty of times in the past, for example, when we had not just a single month, but a quarter. We had 3 months of negative economic growth, but it really wasn't widespread or deep enough or lasted long enough to qualify as a recession. So, I would not be surprised, though, if maybe in a year, the officials that do this, if they look back at the data and they say, wow, the deterioration we're in today, it began last year around August.
Yeah, well, and that's always, it's political. I remember when Bush was running against Obama and they kept saying, oh, recession, recession, recession. And it was amazing how when Obama won and beat Bush, that recession that day just vanished. It was amazing. The media just,
you know, another really good example, Dawn, was when his father, Bush Sr., was running against Clinton, and there had been a recession, except the recession was very clearly already over by the time the campaign started. But the National Bureau of Economic Research, the group that usually dates recessions, they refused to say that the recession had ended. And so by the time the election rolls around, the recession was a year and a half over, and they refused to declare it as such. And so the Clinton campaign was able to go around saying, you have presided over the longest recession in decades, even though the recession was already over. And it wasn't the longest recession in decades, but they got their political talking point, and it got Clinton elected.
Biased media, as we talk about, and sometimes biased by omission. E.J. Antoni, also public finance economist, Richard F. Astor Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Always appreciate you. I love all of your analysis and the fact that your mom is named Dawn, too. That's kind of unusual. Isn't your mom Dawn?
No, she's not.
Same birthday.
I don't know who told you that, but that's fake news.
That's fake news. See, I was giving – people always go too far. They're like, yeah, EJ's mom's June 15th, and her name's Dawn, too. I was like, wow, that's like – kind of weird, you know? That's amazing. Both Geminis.
It would have been an amazing coincidence.
That would have been an amazing coincidence, but there are no coincidences. All right. E.J. Antoni, until next time, my friend, thank you so much. Really appreciate you.